This is R.J. Rush Dooney, Easy Chair Number 297, August 26, 1993. Tonight we have one of our staff with us, Samuel L. Blumenfeld, but we have two of our number absent from us. Douglas Murray is in the Bay Area. His mother is quite ill. Mark Rush Dooney is in Sacramento at the State Fair, where his son Isaac, age 14, won the grand prize and a sum of money for his game birds. And the winner of the reserve grand prize was his sister of 11, April Rush Dooney. So it's been a good week. And it's been a pleasurable week because we've had Sam Blumenfeld with us. Otto and I are going to ask Sam some questions after he gives us an introduction on OBE, and he'll explain what that means. But before he gets started on that, I'd like to call attention to a problem too many people have when they think about public education. They assume that having dropped the Bible, driven out prayer, and introduced sex education, the schools have achieved their goal and things are continuing about as they have been for some years. Many are ready to believe that there actually has been a return to phonics in the schools, which is not true. The name has been used, but it is not true phonics. But statist education is a revolutionary movement. It is not going to stand still. It goes from one thing to another. So that to assume that there is some kind of status quo there is a very, very serious error. And that's why I feel it is so important that we have Sam Blumenfeld here to explain OBE to us. Otto and I will ask some questions, Sam, after a while, but take your time and take as long as you want to develop an exposition of it.
Well, the first thing you have to know about outcome-based education is that it is a totally new form of education meant to replace what's left of traditional education. Now, there isn't very much left of traditional education, but this would be the final blow, which would just sweep away everything that has preceded education in this country up to now. And it is based on the psychological studies of Benjamin Bloom, a professor at the University of Chicago, social scientist, who worked out this a method of education that would produce the desired outcome of the humanists. For example, the desired outcome of a Christian education is a believing Christian, an individual who would have a certain moral background, etc. And a Christian school devises its education, creates a curriculum that creates the product that they want. Well, the same thing now is being done in education to produce humanists who will fit into this new world order that the educators have decided is going to exist. It's going to be humanistic, that is, with no reference to God, no reference to religion. It is also to reflect their vision of what American society is going to be like economically. For example, they see, that is the OBE visionaries, see America as really a kind of three-tier society. You'll have at the very top the universitarian elite, those who are, you might say, born to rule, like Hillary and Billary. You see, they've been chosen by fate, I guess, and they are groomed to be the rulers, this university elite. That's the top tier, and their education, they will be, you might say, guided in that direction if they show that they have some talent, as obviously Bill Clinton showed and Hillary. The second tier will be made up of the managers, the technicians, the scientists, who will keep the economy moving, who will keep the economy working. And then all below them will be the third group, the proles, the workers, who will just get a sufficient education which will make them competitive with the other low-wage earners in the rest of the world. In other words, Americans will be groomed to accept a low-wage status comparable to that what we have now in Mexico or in Taiwan or elsewhere, because they realize that we're losing jobs because Americans are simply paid too much. Well, that's the kind of system that they want, and they're devising a curriculum that is going to produce those results. They are going to create what they call certificates of mastery, a certificate of initial mastery. In other words, it's going to replace the diploma. You see, the present diploma, you get a present diploma by being in school for 12 years and getting various credits. And if you get, you know, 3 credits for this course and 4 credits for that one, and when you have a certain number of credits, you graduate. Here, you will not graduate until you are able to demonstrate that you can, that you know and have the right attitudes that the educators want you to have. In other words, you can be in school for as long as it takes for you to jump through the hoops. If you do not repeat, if you do not ape what they want you to so-called learn, you don't graduate. You don't get your certificate. And from what I've been told, you won't be able to work unless you have a certificate. In other words, that'll be your means of eligibility to get a job. Also, this system is a very controlled system. They are going to put everybody on a computer. Every child who enters the system gets into this master computer, which already exists, incidentally, this master computer that is going to track every single child beginning at the age of 3. Now, they are also going to monitor pregnancies, because they believe that the reason why there are some children who can't learn is because of something that the mother did in pregnancy. In other words, as you know, Rush, and you know, Otto, I've been talking for years about how reading disability is created in the school by the methods that are being used by the educators. Well, of course, they flatly deny that. They claim that the reason why these children aren't learning is because of something genetic or something that happened to them in the womb, or some brain damage, and so now they have an excuse, a pretext for monitoring pregnancies. Now, what are they? I don't know what they're going to do about women who want to abort their fetuses. That's going to be a problem that they're going to have to deal with. But in any case, they will start tracking children from day one. And once you get on the computer, that's it. And they're going to have a file on you that's going to be in the computer, which, and who knows who will have access to it. There's no true security. Otto, I'm sure you know that there's no true security in any computer or data bank.
No, of course not.
Yes. And so that's what they're going to do. Now, as far as subject matter is concerned, they are going to only teach what they believe is needed to solve problems, to solve our problems. For example, they are going to eliminate history as history. They will just deal with problems and then, as they say, they will try to solve whatever problem. For example, if they have a if we have a problem in Bosnia, they will think in terms of, well, now how can we you know, solve that problem, quote, whether they know anything about history or not. They're not going to know much about American history also, because basically they want to destroy the past for these youngsters. They want to create a new person. They have divided the and all of this is being done by psychologists. All of these plans have been made by psychologists, not educators as we would, or intellectuals, or people who are truly interested in the intellect. This is being done by basically by psychologists, and they've divided the curriculum into the cognitive domain and the affective domain. And the affective domain, of course, is related to beliefs and values and emotions and sexuality and all of that. And then they say that even the cognitive domain has its affective aspect, so that you're never free of the emotions. In other words, when I was going to school and I was taught arithmetic or I was taught to read, the teacher did not want to know how I felt. She did not want to know what I believed. She didn't want to know what my parents felt or what they believed. She just wanted to make sure that I knew what she was teaching. Now they want to know how you feel, what your relations are with your family, what your attitudes are. That's going to be very important in this whole new scheme of things.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
Now, what you're telling us is that there's going to be a structural change.
Total, complete structural change.
It's not going to be elementary, intermediate, and college.
No, yeah. Well, there may be universities. They haven't gotten up to the universities. This is going to deal with basically with your public school system, which now goes from K through 12, but they're not going to have them as such as grades. You see, it's not going to be done as grades. Also, they're for example, they're going to have the extended calendar, school calendar. They're eliminating summer vacations because they're saying that that's a relic of an agrarian society, and therefore children should go to school all year round. And also, they're going to mix ages. That's one thing that isn't too bad, the fact that you're not going to only be with your own age group. In other words, it's based on what you are supposed to know. In other words, if you, for example, know the information, you cannot move ahead until you know what they're teaching. In other words, they will repeat it and drum it into you until you can repeat it back, you see. That's the so-called mastery learning system.
There's also the implication that they can keep them beyond 16.
Yes, you see, they're going to have to do something about the compulsory school attendance laws because they don't want these kids to be able to walk out at the age of 16. They want to force these kids to stay in that school until, as I said, they can ape what the educators want them to know. And, of course, that's still up in the air. We don't know exactly what the content is of this education.
I can't see where somebody at the end of 12 years goes into a university. What will they go in equipped with? And what will the university do?
Well, they will go and equip with what they would call a certain values or certain goals. Now the government is setting these goals. Incidentally, this is going to create a totally national education system. Forget about local control.
Same everywhere.
Yes, it's got to be the same everywhere. And of course it's the federal government that has been paying for all of this up till now. You see, it's the U.S. Department of Education, which has been pumping millions of dollars into these education labs that are located all over the country, that are producing these various programs. They're all psychologically based because they want to change the attitudes of the students to conform with humanistic goals. So in other words, if you're a Christian, you're going to have a very tough time in that school, because the schools are going to say, tell you that evolution is a fact. And they won't let you out until you agree, right. In other words, you will not be able to disagree and get your certificate, you see. That's the kind of thing we're headed for. We're headed toward educational totalitarianism. And it's being introduced and implemented all over the country, and people don't even know what's happening.
This would render everyone else obsolete.
Oh, yeah.
Apart from you and two or three who have, under your influence, taken up the matter, no one is calling attention to the implications of OBE.
Phyllis Schlafly is.
Yeah, she has. She has, and...
I wasn't to work with her.
Yeah. Phyllis has done a good... She did a good report on it. And we have a network of people in the country who are aware of what is going on. And we're on the phone all the time and exchanging faxes and doing all kinds of things. We've been aware of OBE now for a while. I think the one person who was probably aware of it for quite some time is Charlotte Iserbit, who lives in Maine, who was once worked for the Department of Education. She saw all of these grant proposals going through. She knows who the major individuals involved in this whole process are, and she is she's very well aware of it. She's been ahead of us, but the method of education is basically Skinnerian. This mastery education methodology, it's basically behaviorist. The use of the animal training techniques, you see, to educate these youngsters. And incidentally, what they're going to teach the ones at the very bottom. First of all, they're not going to learn how to read very well, because whole language is now part and parcel of this whole program. Whole language, and as you know, as I've spoken about whole language before, it is a dumbing down process, mm-hmm. so that they will be relegating that lower, probably two-thirds of the population.
Well, what would be the criteria for selecting the lower?
Well, it's very hard to say. You know, you have your so-called gifted and talented. What they will do is find out who can survive, who manages to get through. I mean, for example, how does a Clinton become a Clinton? I mean, he went to private schools,
yeah. And he obviously was an expert apple polisher.
Yes.
And just the type that the teachers like.
Yes. Well, obviously there are going to be some kids who are bright and who will be selected to be the rulers of tomorrow, just as Clinton was.
There's, of course, an obvious plagiarism in all this. The three-tiered society is straight out of Plato's Republic, which is the great pattern for all totalitarian societies. And the proles, the proletariat, of course, are those who could not qualify for anything else, so they were like cattle to be used by the planners at the top.
Exactly.
But in this instance, you know, Plato was living, after all, as a member of a nobility. And the proles were born into that situation. Mm-hmm. And the middle class, if they're what it was the entrepreneur of the day. Here, obviously, the schools or the psychologists will select irrespective mm-hmm. of race or family.
Oh, yes.
Now, this is a great illusion that race is irrelevant.
Well, but, you know, they have devised all sorts of tests, mm-hmm. attitudinal tests,
right.
Values tests, which will permit them to select those, you know, by computer they can do this very easily.
Sure.
Everything's going to be on a computer.
Right.
They'll be able to select very easily who are mm-hmm. the ones destined to be the rulers,
sure,
to be the ruling class, the elite. It's right. an elitist society.
Right.
All socialist societies are elitist societies.
All societies are elitist. There's no society without a top.
Yes.
So that's a term which I really don't see. I know that it's frowned upon today. They use elitist as a pejorative. But if you don't have an elite, you don't have a society.
Well, yeah, we've always had an elite in this country, but our education system left it up to the
individual
to That's decide right. what he was going to do with his life.
More of a meritorious, well, a natural right. elite in Jefferson's terms.
Yeah.
A natural aristocracy.
A natural yes. aristocracy. Here it is, I mean, let me ask you, do you consider Hillary and Bill Clinton to be elite in the sense of knowledge?
No, of course not.
They're not elite material. So no. How did they get there?
Well, of course they were pushed through.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I don't know, Rush, if you recall the speech that Clinton gave when he received the nomination of the Democratic Party. And in that address, he paid homage to his great professor at Georgetown University, Professor Carol Quigley.
Yes.
Now, 99.9% of the American people had no idea who was Professor Quigley. But as you and I know, Rush, Professor Quigley wrote a very famous book called Tragedy and Hope, in which he explained the existence yes. of the establishment of this group of men who were working secretly to create a world system. And obviously Clinton was aware of that, and the Rhodes scholarships, as a matter of fact.
Well, he was a Rhodes scholar.
Yes.
And of course, he did. It's interesting. He worked for Fulbright.
Yes.
But he didn't get a Fulbright. He got a Rhodes scholar because a Rhodes scholar has a little more prestige. And of course, at Oxford, you don't have to work if you don't want to. It's not like an American college. So he didn't work his second year. He never got his degree
yeah.
there.
You don't have to, but the purpose of the Rhodes Scholarship is to train leaders.
Well, it's to put you into a network.
Yeah, because, you know, Hawkes, the Prime Minister of Australia, was a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah.
You've got Rhodes Scholars throughout our Congress.
It's really a political appointment.
Yeah, in a sense. So it is. So we do have this elite at the top, but it's an elite that's chosen by the manipulators.
Well, it's interesting. This is a fascinating. Phyllis Schlafly. I just happened to run across her. Somebody sent me a copy of what she'd written, and it wasn't as clear as what Sam was saying by any means. She got all bound up in the curricula.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We have already an academic elite that is running our society.
Yes.
That is a certificated elite.
Credentialed.
A credentialed elite, yes. And they're doing a lousy job because most of them are not educated. They're mm-hmm. specialists. And the specialization is so intense that it leaves them totally ignorant outside their specialty.
You see, now you believe that they're doing a lousy job, but to them, what we have is what they want.
This chaos?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, take, for example, the illiteracy that we have in this country. We know how to teach children to read. It's no big mystery. I mean, it isn't as if we're trying to find a cure for cancer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after all, the Romans did it.
Yes.
The Greeks did it.
Well,
we've done it in this country.
This country did it very,
yes.
very well.
Right.
Yes.
Now, and I've been fighting to get intensive phonics back in the schools since 1963. And it's been like hitting your head against a stone wall.
By that time, there were articles in Harper's and elsewhere which said that one-third, at least, of all the children in America were not literate and did not need to know how to read.
In 65, 63?
Yes. And you've encountered that in educational literature in the 20s.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when I was in California a couple of years ago down in the San Joaquin Valley, I visited a school, Washington Elementary School in Selma, California, a small town.
Very well.
A friend of mine, Sue Dixon, wrote a good phonics program, and I asked Sue, I said, well, where is it being used in America? And she said, well, there's this little school in Selma, California that's using it. Why don't you go down, if you're there, visit? And I happened to be in the area, so I stopped off and I went to see the principal, a very nice young lady, whose name I can't recall at the moment, who welcomed me in, and, you know, and I asked her about how she got to use this phonetic system, which was teaching these little children from migrant workers to read very nicely.
Mm.
And she said, well, when she had gone to Teachers College, I forget it was Fresno or one of the universities there, her professor told her to expect that one-third of the children would not learn to read, could not learn because of some defect.
That's ridiculous.
A second third would only become moderate readers, and only one-third would become proficient readers. So she left school believing that that was so, and she started teaching, and she was so frustrated and so disturbed by the failure that she was getting with the programs that she was using, some look-say program, that she thought there must be a better way to do things. And she happened to come across Sue Dixon's program in a catalog. So she sent away for it and began using it in her class, and lo and behold, everybody learned to read, you see. So she was suddenly realized that she had been lied to. She had been lied to by her professor.
I remember, if you'll pardon the interruption, at about 1963, running into a literary agent who was agenting for children's books. And I said, well, I guess anyone with a flair for fantasy would probably do rather well in that field. And she said, no. She said, we deal with limited vocabulary by age.
Yes.
And not only were the words limited, but you could only use those words.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I've been working with a very interesting gentleman down in North Carolina who read my book, The NEA, and read that particular chapter on the artificial inducement of dyslexia. Now, he himself is dyslexic. And for the first time, he realized that the reason why he had his problem was because of the way he had been taught to read in school. And he was very concerned about his grandson, who was having a terrible time learning to read. And so what he would do is he'd buy these little phonetic books. Now, even though this man was dyslexic, he had somehow managed to read enough. And his grandson had this block against phonics. And he said, now how could that be? How did this happen? Well, he looked at the books that his grandson was reading, and he realized he had all of these Dr. Seuss books, which he could read like that, snap of a finger.
Sure.
So he began to test it. He realized that this boy was memorizing the Dr. Seuss books, all of the words, holistically, as little, you know, right. figures, as little ideographs.
Right.
And because he had this automatic, holistic way of looking at words, had developed a block against looking at words phonetically, you see. And so this was a great discovery, because millions of preschoolers are memorizing these little Dr. Seuss books. Now, the interesting thing is that Dr. Seuss did not write these books out of his head. He was given 220 words by the publisher, sight words, that the purpose of these books was to turn these kids into little sight readers, so that when they entered the first grade, Oh, they would be able to read very nicely, and their parents would be very satisfied and would say, oh, my child is learning to read, you see.
Right.
But then by the time they got to the third grade, they'd break down and become dyslexic and have all kinds of problems. Mm. So my friend devised a very simple test whereby he could discover or find out whether the child was a sight reader, was looking at words holistically or phonetically. He took the sight words from the Dr. Seuss books and put them in on a page, and then he took an equal number of words from Rudolf Flesch's book, Why Johnny Can't Read, simple phonetically regular words. Well, the typical sight reader would whiz through the Dr. Seuss words, but then when he would come to the simple phonetic words, he'd stumble, be unable to read them, slow down considerably.
Couldn't read them at all.
Yes. So he was able to demonstrate quite dramatically this difference.
Well, the method you've described and the damage that they've created is really diabolic. And Bob, who is running the tape for us, said, why are they doing this?
Yeah, why are they doing this? Well, it's part of the general dumbing down of the American people. First of all, you have to realize that the end aim of American education, or the educators, the elite, the progressives, is to create a world socialist pagan system. We know it's going to be pagan because if you attended the conference at Rio, you would realize that everything is tending toward a pagan system. Now, who are those who will be the most resistant group to a world pagan socialist system?
Well, the religious groups.
The believing Christians.
Yes.
They represent the strongest opposition. Now, this group realizes that that's the case. Now, how can you destroy that opposition? Well, since 85% of the Christians put their children in public schools, you see, what they are going to do is do two things to the kids. First, they're going to dumb them down sufficiently so that they can't read the Bible, they can't read the Declaration of Independence, they can't read the Constitution. In other words, they will be completely at the mercy of their superiors. That's the first thing they will do to make them pliable and easily manipulable. The second thing they will do is sexualize the children as early as possible in order to make them into pagans. Now, so that's why they're introducing sex education in kindergarten, AIDS education in kindergarten, which they're going to describe to these 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds, all of the various ways that you can get AIDS. And they're going to leave nothing to the imagination.
As I read recently, they do this, Rush, as an illustration of what's happening in their parents' bedroom.
Is that what it is?
That's part of it. And that, of course, changes a child's whole
yes.
attitude toward his parents.
Right. We also, go ahead, Rush.
I was going to say, and by way of illustration, what you said with regard to not being able to read the Bible, one of the most common practices in the first half of this century was that in the Sunday school, various children were asked to read the lesson from the Bible. Or they went around the class, each one reading a verse very often. Since then, that's less and less the case, because they cannot read it if they are public school students.
Yes.
There is an interesting cartoon in the September Reader's Digest that Bob handed me. It shows this college hallway and the door on which is the inscription History Department, and underneath the sign closed for rewriting.
Well, it's interesting, the Russians are rewriting their history books because they know they're full of lies, And we're rewriting ours in order to put more lies in. But getting back to this why they're doing this, that's the only way that they can overcome the Christian opposition is to first produce fewer Christians. In other words, de-Christianize Christian children. Now, once they become sexualized, then they will be in conflict with their Christian beliefs. And they will have what is, they will develop what is known as cognitive, what is it, cognitive disorder, not cognitive, oh, I forget, there's a term that the scientists, that the psychologists have devised, which is a description of internal conflict. Dissonance, cognitive dissonance. It's called cognitive dissonance. Which means that the youngster will have these two conflicting value systems, two conflicting belief systems. He will have been experimenting with sex, and he or she will have to decide, well, can I remain a Christian or should I adopt humanism, which says that I can do everything I want, you see. And more likely than not, the individual will become a humanist or an atheist or a nihilist or you name it, but they certainly will give up Christianity because it's much more difficult to lead a Christian life than it is to lead a humanist life. And as we know from the growth of the New Age movement, one of the reasons why so many people are adopting pagan beliefs is because paganism lets you do all the sinning you want.
Well, the modern version of paganism.
Yes.
I mean, we know that the pagans had gods and rules. We are worse than they're propounding is worse than the pagans.
Well, the pagans also had human sacrifice.
Yes.
Which
we'll come to that.
Yeah, probably.
Yes. Well, there are different ways of sacrificing people.
Yeah.
To an extent, the treatment of our troops in Vietnam was human sacrifice.
And abortion.
Absolutely. And abortion.
And abortion.
So
and
we
human
have
sacrifice.
Human sacrifice going on today. The point is, though, that I hope that answers the question as why they're doing this. Because their aim is the socialist pagan system.
For power and control, in other words.
Yeah. And to de-Christianize the opposition. In other words, if you can take 85% of the Christian children, and how long would it take? One or two generations to de-Christianize them? Not very long.
Not too
long. And then
long.
You just have a remnant that you have to deal with.
If you have
a very small remnant.
If nobody can get a job without a credential.
Yes.
Now, when I worked at Ashton Oil, I was the only man in the headquarters that was there without a degree. I found out later the personnel department would not interview anyone without a degree.
Sure, yes.
And this was set in place by men, who were the first in their generation to get a degree. In their families to get a degree.
You know what is interesting also is that the business people have been brought into this thing by the educators, mm-hmm. and the business people are being persuaded that high literacy is not necessary. They're being told that it's better to have a lower level. A lower level of literacy for these workers, because we don't want to create false hopes that they can rise to the middle class. In other words, we want to make them satisfied with their place in society as laborers, as workers, doing whatever it is that industry is going to require, you see. So they're selling this to the large corporations, and believe it or not, the large corporations are going along with it, which is a terrible.
Do you suppose that that's a result of having distributed degrees wholesale?
Yes.
In this last couple of decades, and then produce people who expect more from society than it has places to provide.
That's it. That's it. So as you have pointed out to me, Otto, we're entering a period of tremendous change in which there are going to be fewer jobs.
Yes.
You see, now of course in our society, it's the small firms that have created the jobs.
Right.
The large corporations are cutting back. I mean, you know, they're cutting down by the thousands. While it's the creation of these small firms of 20 people, 30 people, that are creating the jobs. Now, how long that's going to last, we don't know, because according to the new tax program, they're going to penalize these smaller entrepreneurs and these small firms.
Well, most of them have discovered that they previously cracked down on S corporations, which are small
yes.
corporations, increased the taxes. So therefore, most of the new entrepreneurs have been operating on their own personal account without incorporating at all, so they're charged according to the income tax rates. Well, when you put the income tax rates up to 40%, which is the latest bill,
yes.
39%, plus the state and the county, you are taking over half of what these entrepreneurs can make,
yeah.
what they can earn.
To illustrate what you said earlier about the absorption of the business community, some years ago a man who had been in banking in New York City and had done some investigative work for Congress in areas of his expert knowledge, told me that routinely the people with money were absorbed into the establishment, and he cited the instance of one family, a man, a successful businessman, who left a foundation of not too many million, but one that provided, $4 to $6 million a year for grants, which he hoped would go to good Christian and conservative causes. When he died, his widow turned over control of it to the three sons who'd already been a part of the board. After some time, she learned from friends with horror that all the money that her husband had made was being given in grants to left-wing causes. And she called in someone to investigate the matter, and it ended with the investigation because it was obvious nothing was going to happen. The boys were in control. It was simply this. The first time the three sons took a trip to Europe before they went, a State Department official visited them, told them that they were the kind of tourists to Europe they wanted to see more of. So would they mind if they had them met when they arrived in London, visit some prominent Englishman and stay at their estates, and so on? Well, they were entranced at the idea, and they came back walking on air because they met lords and ladies, and wherever they went, chauffeurs met them, courtesy of the embassy, and they were included in a variety of things that were quite heady for them. They were meeting the elite. They came back. They were invited to a prominent social event in New York City. They were asked to talk to a small group about their reactions. and they were walking on air. A little later, someone called on them and discreetly solicited funds for a project in New York City. And they quickly realized that if they wanted the same kind of association as they had encountered on the trip to Europe, this was the way to do it. So little by little, all the money that was available every year was going to causes suggested to them. Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of thing that is done, and other methods no doubt, to absorb the wealth that Christian and conservative men have laid up into the New World Order.
Oh, yes, there's the famous Sun Oil, you know, fund,
yes.
Fortune Pugh.
Joe Pugh, yeah.
Who had endowed Grove City College and was a great contributor to conservative...
Rush. I knew him personally.
And now, where is it? It's all going to left-wing, liberal...
Yes.
Causes because these foundations are taken over by these people.
Well, I know for a fact that Pugh left some grants that were to be permanent to certain organizations. And his instructions were carefully spelled out. But within a year after his death, these had been cut out.
How could they do that if they're...
Oh, they can do whatever they want. The courts are not agreeable to permanent wishes.
That's true.
The Girard case is an example of that.
Yes, that set a precedent.
There's also the fact that the courts have, the government first and then the courts followed, have destroyed private contracts.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not living under contractual law anymore. And a judge can set aside...
Anything.
Anything. any contract.
Yes.
And are doing it regularly.
Yeah.
So that the restructuring of society is underway. You're giving us the educational side.
Right.
Of it.
And they call it restructuring.
They call it...
Oh, yes, it's called restructuring.
Well, that's what it strikes me immediately.
Yes. And but that's what they call it. And, of course, that's what they want. My friend in North Carolina, Edward Miller, has used that test, you know, the sight words on one side.
Mm-hmm.
He's gone to a public school in his area, and he tested the children in that school, the Rhonda Klingman school. I just wanted to give you what the results were. He said of the 26 second graders, only 4 could be considered good phonetic readers out of 26 second
mm-hmm.
graders.
Mm-hmm.
And then of the 25 fourth graders, only 7 mm. were phonetic readers. And so it turned out of that, to sum up the results, of the 68 children tested, 53 were already educationally dyslexic.
Great. It just occurs to me that when you say nobody would be able to get a job without a credential from
right.
this system,
yes.
that is the way to stop the outlaw individual from rising in society. Now, this is a very old prejudice. Emerson had it and his friends against the men who set up the mills and the factories
right,
and
yes.
the railroads and mm-hmm. so forth because they hadn't gone through the university system. And it was felt that only the people who went through the university system had a right to rise in the society and others did not. So you close that door of the entrepreneur. What you're really talking about is creating a China.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you see the difference is striking. We've had many immigrants to this country who were basically illiterate.
Yes.
And were able to build fortunes.
That's right.
And that's because their minds had not been tampered with. They were illiterate simply because they hadn't
learned to read, hadn't had schooling, but yet they had native intelligence.
Sure.
They had common sense. You know, they knew up from down, they knew right from wrong, and they knew that what capitalism was all about.
Well, but some of them arrived here illiterate only in English.
Right. But the functional illiterate, who is made illiterate in our schools, becomes generally so dysfunctional, becomes a delinquent, becomes antisocial.
So they really figured out a way.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Kurt Lewin, one of the social scientists who came out of Germany in the 30s and came to this country, and he invented sensitivity training.
Hmm.
And he was responsible for creating the National Training Lab in Bethel, Maine, which was sponsored by the National Education Association. He experimented on how to create frustration, how to frustrate children.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew how to do it. You see, they had worked on all of these techniques. So what functional literacy creates is what you have in Los Angeles, in South Central Los Angeles, gangs of functional illiterates who have no employable skills.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, when Rodney King was on the stand and he was asked to read something, he looked at it and he said, would somebody read it for me? I can't read. I think if these gangs were tested for literacy, you would find that 95% were probably functionally illiterate. You see.
Well, you mentioned the immigrants who came here unable to read English. Back in the 20s and 30s, I know California and briefly, or for a few years, Michigan, one of the commonest things was your night school for immigrants who went there to learn how to read and write and to speak English properly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a course that required a great deal of drill, and it was not a snap course. They really taught those people. And they went there because they had the motivation.
Oh, yeah.
They wanted to get ahead.
Oh, yes.
Of course. Of course.
In night school in those
days. You remember
days.
The Education of Hyman Kaplan?
Oh, yeah.
Delightful book.
Right.
Yes, now, that was a classic in its day, and I don't think I've thought of it for maybe 40 years since you mentioned it now.
Yeah.
That was a joy to read.
It was.
I read it 2-3 times.
Yes. But it's interesting that so many of those immigrants were able to do so well over here. Of course, they had the opportunity.
Yes.
But they had common sense. Their
and
brains
the
had not
was
been
not
destroyed.
Locked up at the time they arrived.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it is locked up. When I tell you that this large company wouldn't interview anybody that didn't have a degree, that's a lockup.
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
Incidentally, another important thing that was done by Miller was that he went back to this Rhonda Klingman school 2 years later to test the same youngsters that he had tested in 1990. He was able to test 51 of the original 68 students, and here the results are really astounding. He proved the dumbing down was taking place. He said, the results showed that none of the students who were holistic readers in 1990 had become phonetic readers in the interim. Most of them were able to read the words faster and their accuracy had increased in the phonetic part of the test, but more than half of the dyslexic students miscalled some of the very same sight words that they had read correctly in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
One student who as a fourth grader had made a total of 12 errors in 1990 made 29 errors in 1992 as a sixth grader in the very same first grade test.
Yes.
This is the same test given 2 years later, and they make more errors 2 years later on the same first grade test. And nowhere was the dumbing down process more obvious than among the good phonetic readers in the second and third grades of 1990, who are now in the fourth and sixth grades. Of the 13 students who had achieved the best scores in 1990, 9 made more errors on the very same test in 1992.
All right, now McIntyre is teaching children. He has a day school. It's a real school.
Right.
He's teaching them as students. It takes them in as soon as they're toilet trained. And I think the senior class is 6 years old, I'm not sure, whenever they have to go on to the first grade. And most of the parents put them onto the first grade because, of course, that ends the expense of the day school.
Mm-hmm.
And these are single parents or people that have to work hard. So what you're saying is that when the public schools get them, now he turns them out able to read and write, they're going to destroy that ability.
Absolutely.
That's what you're saying.
Yes, and he proved it with this testing. I was amazed. The results were astounding. This is the first objective evidence we have of the dumbing down process, mm-hmm. whereby the best students read more poorly 2 years later. The very same first grade test. This is not a more difficult test. The very same test they're doing more poorly. As a matter of fact, one fourth grader who had made only 2 errors in 1990 made 18 in 1992 as a sixth grader.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that sound right?
You see. Yeah. So what we're dealing with is a dumbing down process that has been worked out so cleverly. I mean, it's an ingenious thing that they've done. Diabolical.
A little while ago, we were talking about the lockup of various areas, closed any but those who are credentialed. An interesting area where that has happened has been in the churches. Originally, you could study theology under a prominent theologian or a pastor. All you had to do was to pass the examination. That went out in most churches by the time of World War II. I think one of the last where it went out was, strangely enough, the Episcopal Church. All you had to do was to pass the bishop's examinations, but that ended. Now, what has happened is that the churches blessed with seminaries have gone downhill. The phenomenal growth from 68 to 88 of those who profess to be born-again, Bible-believing Christians is from 40 million to 91 million, 18 years of age and older, mm-hmm. has been churches that did not require a seminary training. Just a man who knew what it was about, who'd studied on his own. Now, two things are obvious. There was a risk. Not that these other churches didn't have their share of incompetent and morally delinquent men. But let's grant for a moment that those who did not require the lockup process of seminaries and credentials and all that, let's say maybe they had more delinquent clergymen. They had the phenomenal success because the men had not been trained to knuckle under to a system, but were driven by a mission.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I think it was Fred Niles who told me in Australia that the whole purpose of the seminary was to destroy his religion.
Yes.
I don't know if he told you that.
That's very common.
But they wanted to produce doubt in him over the inerrancy of the word. And I understand that there are thousands of young men who have entered seminaries with a heart full of spirit, willing to, wanting to become great ministers, and yet the seminaries have virtually destroyed their faith.
Well, even where the faith has not been destroyed. It has drilled them into a straight, a life that is a straitjacket
yes.
life.
Uh-huh.
So that I've actually seen young men who preached marvelously before they went to seminary come out and they were wooden and incompetent. Well, our time is virtually over. Before we conclude, I'd like to urge you all to subscribe to the Blumenfeld Education Letter, which comes out every month and is usually about 10 pages.
Eight
pages.
Yes.
The rate is $36 for a year. For a subscription, write to the Blumenfeld Education Letter, P.O. Box 45161, Boise, V as in boy, O-I-S-E, Idaho, 83711. I think you'll find it eminently worthwhile. It'll keep you up to date on the kind of thing we've been talking about this evening.
Rush, you might give them the phone number. It would be easier for them to call.
All right. Call 208-322-4440. Thank you all for listening, and God bless you.